welcome to Data Science Perspectives. This series focuses on analytics and data science professionals from across industry to learn about how their career unfolded, what skills they look for when hiring, and what trends they think are coming next. I'm your host, Bill Franks. Let's get to it. Welcome to this episode of Data Science Perspectives. I'm your host, Bill Franks. Today, we're going to be joined by Rasmus Wegner from Bain & Company, the management consulting firm. Rasmus and I first met, it's probably been 6 or 7 years ago now. He and I have just always kept in touch ever since. I think you'll find Rasmus brings a unique perspective to the analytics and data science world due to his extended work with senior executives through his management advisory consulting. He's seen how business leaders have begun to adopt analytics over the last few decades, as well as how that's led to business process and strategy changes. From his work in guiding these companies that he's worked with, he's truly had a top-down view of the rise of analytics in the past 10 to 20 years, and I think you're going to enjoy hearing from him today. He's got a master's in medical information from the University of Utah and a PhD in medical physics from the University of Tübingen over in Germany. And with that, let's welcome Rasmus to the show. Well, thanks for joining me on the show today, Rasmus.
Thank you, Bill, for having me. It's a pleasure to see you again.
You as well. And what I always like to start with is a question about how folks got into the world of analytics. And in your case, you went directly into management consulting from school at a time when not only was analytics not really a thing in business at large yet, but I'm assuming wasn't really a thing within your company yet either. So how did you end up getting into analytics in that environment?
So now you make me become really old here. So in the 90s, when I finished up my career in academia, my work was fully related around Monte Carlo simulations as part of radiation treatment planning. And so there was as much data and as much analytics and heavy computing, I think, as it got in the regular academic environment, right? And so I brought that with me as a physicist with a math and a computing background. So I always liked that topic. I always liked physics. I always liked math. I had a knack for that. And so that is what I did prior to consulting. And when I joined consulting and Bain in particular, I joined a firm that prides itself, rightly so, that we are extremely data driven. Right? That's been part of our mission statement forever. And we are just working that way, in a very, very data-driven manner. Now, obviously, when I first had exposure to management consulting in 98, a lot of that was with folks who were learning to do work with Excel, who had come from Lotus 1-2-3. And so some of the more modern tools that we used in academia were new to them. But it kind of like evolved just from that we had projects, and when they were heavily influenced by data and analytics, it was kind of like, hey, can you come help out here? And so that became kind of like part of my profile, I guess, in the firm from the very start.
So you actually, I know this happens to a lot of people in analytics, where you almost accidentally end up starting an analytics team because you can do it, and you just kept getting asked to do it. Next thing you know, that's what you're spending a lot of time on, and you're building more people. And so over time, I guess, how has the analytics that you've done, I assume it's evolved alongside how your clients have evolved, but have you also evolved how you're analyzing Bain's internal business over time?
Yeah, and so we've always had a team that would work with, call it, for instance, customer data, right? That is one of the elements that generated already tons of data in the 90s, right? We have always had a team like that. That evolved to several hundred folks today that I would call data scientists, right? So that has changed. I believe our work, by and large, over the last 20 years or so, or 25 years that I've been around, hasn't dramatically changed in terms of the topics. I think two-thirds or so of the topics that were important to our client executives in the 90s are still very relevant and important today, right? So the topics haven't changed. What has changed, I think, is that other third of new topics that are highly linked towards digital and analytics, right? That stuff just wasn't around 20 plus years ago. And in that realm, we could talk separately, but what therefore has changed is the types of use cases of what you do with data, right? Back in the 90s, a big piece of working with data was around the quarterly earning runs, for instance, doing this type of work with big mainframe machines still, right? And in today's environment, it is about real-time pricing and real-time advertisement and garnering the power of analytics at a much more holistic, transformative scale. So one third of our business, I would say, has changed topic-wise. And then what has changed, right, is how we deliver the work for, well, that one third that's new, but for the other two thirds, right? So the team that is dedicated to analytics and data has grown exponentially. The tools the consultants use every day have expanded from the traditional Excel and being data dogs to include a whole host of other tools. And then I say the work has gotten much quicker and more precise in a range of areas. For instance, when you think about back in the days, you would visit stores and take counts of how many cars were in a parking lot and where on a shelf certain elements or SKUs would be sitting. Today, you can look at 1,000 plus retail outlets of a big Bain client with satellite images at different types of times of the day over different times of the year, right? You can, in an automated fashion, count which cars are there early in the morning, you know, their employees versus the customers, and you can compare that with the competition and you can see and measure the impact of marketing campaigns, for instance, for in-person visits in a store in a much more precise and holistic and quicker fashion than we could in the past. And so the day-to-day tools have expanded, but also I think the approach overall to come up with really good answers has gotten a turbo boost.
That's an interesting use case you mentioned about the monitoring the parking lots. I remember a couple of years ago being impressed with one of the large grocery chains had begun to monitor their own parking lots in real time. And they had identified that there was, I forget what it was, 10 minutes, 20 minutes gap between when a rush of people hit the parking lot before they hit the registers. Okay. And so when they saw an influx, they'd send an alert to the store manager that might say, you know, you're going to need to open 2, 3, whatever it is, more registers. You've got 15 minutes, but it gave the local employees time, you know, time to plan.
Right.
If you're in the middle of unpacking a box, now it's unpack the box, grab a drink, and then go up to number one versus, oh my gosh, there's a, you know, customers are complaining, run to number one right away.
Right.
There's some really fascinating things you can do.
Right. So video analytics, which is really a tough part, right, compute-wise, but video analytics, photo analytics has really seen a growth of adoption in our industry and with our cases, our projects, with many of the clients in retail in particular, I guess is a good example for that, right? But that's not where it ends, right? If you think about those types of use cases, everyone is wondering, what are the use cases of where and how I can use analytics? And it's not limited to that, obviously.
So that brings up an interesting point. You know, you're talking about a wide range of analytics. So not just Bain, but the management consulting space in general. Is it now a virtual requirement that you have some type of analytics competency if you're going to get hired at the firms? Or are the analytics still kind of in some of the, you know, the special teams that focus on those projects, and you have people still getting hired that are completely non-analytical for, you know, more of the traditional strategy projects that you might do?
No, I think there is still a fairly high bar of having to have an analytical mindset to be successful in this industry. The range of tools we use every day that our team members from the very first day will have on their laptops has expanded, right? It's Excel, but now it's also Tableau. We have folks who are coming from schools and already know Python, several know Power BI or R. And so the expectation is still that every team will have a few folks who are really good at using several of the analytical tools. And they don't have to bring this with them, by the way, right? It's our model is very much an apprenticeship model where we hire the smartest and brightest and train them day in and day out to be able to come up with the best answers for our clients. And we just can't do that anymore without those tools. So there's a lot of assimilation and learning through just assimilation on project teams day in and day out. Now, that said, obviously there are some data sets that are too big to be handled by a laptop when someone travels. Sometimes the questions are so highly statistical and difficult mathematically that we will use our central team to help us come up with the answers, right? If you think about some of the big distributors in the industry, right, with hundreds of thousands of SKUs, and you're working on a pricing project with them, there's no way that a team of three or four could solve this mathematically on their machines, right? And so for those areas, we use more central teams that are dedicated to analytics that very often have a very different background. They might not have an MBA, but a PhD in mathematics or in physics or the like, or statistics. They're taking care of those types of questions. But that's not the majority of our projects. I'd say the vast majority of our projects has heavy analytics, but they are being solved by the team members and the teams themselves.
So no, a big part of your job, particularly now that you're more senior, is, you know, working with the executives at a company and often having to guide them towards, you know, recommend and get them to make a decision that might be quite unpalatable to them at times, right? That isn't something that they necessarily want to do, but that, you know, your work shows. How do you approach that when you're going into a room with some executives that are paying your bill, but you know that you have to go in and tell them something they don't want to hear? Is that something that you get, that you learn through practice, or is there a specific strategy you use for that?
Well, I think some folks learn that through practice, and it's a personality thing, I'll say. There's a learning curve, of course, but let's be pragmatic, is I guess my headline there. Coming from academia, and you might appreciate that given your current role, right? What I did certainly have to learn over the last 20 plus years is that no matter how good the argument, how compelling the data is, folks don't necessarily just trust the data, they trust you. So it is a people's business, right? And so just recognizing, you asked, how do we do this? How do I do this? Just recognizing there are very different personal styles, very different company cultures, certainly, that we have to work with. Understanding, therefore, the sensitivities, the pressure points of the executive teams and the rest of the organization is really important. And also recognizing that even the rightest and best answers are pretty useless if there's not a compelling argument of why they are priority and how they can get executed, right? Very often the 60 or 70% answer is much more preferred if it can get executed than the 90 or 100% answer that creates a lot of resistance. And so those are just the realities in society and in the microcosmos of our clients across the world, right? So being pragmatic, lots of communication, over communication, investing into people, really important, right? Making folks not just understand the facts and the analyses, but making them felt that they're being heard and have influence, not necessarily on what the rightest answer is, but of how you package the answer in such a way that it's coming down from the 90 or 100% answer to the 60 or 70% answer that is digestible and can get accepted and executed. I think those are things you learn over the years, and certainly some folks are quicker on that learning curve than others. That's very central to, I think, our roles as consultants, and we cannot take away of that importance by having better data or analytics, right? They're still important, very, very important and central to what we do every day, but it doesn't take away from that people's component.
And knowing, you know, you personally end up spending more of your time at the upper layers of an organization, and I'm sure this has changed over the years, but today, as we sit here in 2022, what are the biggest complaints you hear from executives about the barriers they have in getting their organizations to actually adopt analytics and allow analytics to take a bigger role within their day-to-day decision-making and operational processes?
Yeah. So maybe the interesting thing there, the first one, is that it's typically not the executive team not wanting more to have more analytics or more data, right? I think what we do see is that culture eats strategy for breakfast, and it also eats better analytics for breakfast, right? And so the question that I hear a lot is, okay, when we have the right answer of how can we use that to influence the dialogue rather than to create an answer that is just the piece of analytics. So that part, culture change of an organization, is still, I say, top number one or two or three, maybe in some organizations, priority for most senior executives. And then the barriers to getting more out of analytics, that path to value is challenged, of course, by the question around, do we have the talent to drive this type of analytics in perpetuity after a consultant leaves, right? So there's a talent question. There then is a question of, well, how do you anchor better analytics in the everyday work? And then thirdly, what is that path to value to say, well, investing into analytics, into better analytics, into better insights, it's actually worth it versus the many other priorities an organization has, right? Priorities and requirements for investments elsewhere, for not creating too many distractions and too many projects on the key folks in an organization. And so it's really about, can you create a compelling path, sometimes a narrow path, but a compelling path towards using analytics where it matters. And so this question around identifying and defining the right use cases and building, say, projects and teams and ultimately business value around use case of analytics, I'd say that is the one of the top things we help our clients with, and that's probably one of the biggest adoption hurdles that we see, because that's something that's hard, right? That's difficult. If an organization hasn't been grown in the cloud or born in the cloud, grown in the cloud or digital to begin with, right? So finding a team, finding the right topics and creating value with it, creating a couple of lighthouse success stories, Bill, and then taking those lighthouse success stories as proof points and then expanding the footprint of analytics and the impact it has on everyday life in an organization, I think that's the path that we help chaperone for many of my clients.
And I guess, you know, my question actually had an inherent assumption that I will validate real quick, which was, what do the senior executives complain about that they have in terms of pushback of adopting analytics? Are senior executives, for the most part today, bought into analytics? In other words, is your focus on what are we going to do and how are we going to do it? How are we going to make it happen? Or do you still see senior execs that are pushing back on the data and the analytics that you're bringing to the table?
Well, of course, they sometimes push back on the question, the sources of the data and the quality of the data. And you would expect that, right? There's a quality control there. But nobody's pushing back on the idea of the principal value of analytics in an abstract way. What folks do question and want to see proof points for is, how will it create value for an organization, right? Those are business leaders that need to create business value. And there is no point in pushing analytics for analytics' sake. Analytics has its role in certain topics and areas and not in others. And the question, therefore, is prove to me that it will create value, right? Is there a there? And then folks are more willing to invest behind building the capability or making the changes based on the insights a team creates. Now, very often, right, it's not us coming up with an answer and the client going execute. It's quite the opposite. It's always highly, highly collaborative. There's a lot of transfer of capability, of learning, so that ideally, right, when we leave, when the project ends, the client is fully self-sufficient to continue down the path that is being set by a project.
So I don't think I'm giving away anything secret, given your accent, that you didn't grow up in the U.S. You know, you grew up over in Europe, but then you ended up coming over to the U.S. to work, and you've stayed here for many decades. So what made you jump over the pond, and then what's kept you here, and what are the differences you see in if you did your same type of role you're doing here in the U.S. versus over in Europe? Is there a difference in terms of how business is done, in your opinion?
Well, of course, there are cultural differences, just like between companies, there are cultural differences between countries, right? You didn't give away too much, really, Bill. So I went to high school in Alabama. You can take the the boy out of the South, but not the South of the boy. I'm going to refrain from singing any Baptist hymns here with you. My wife has a PhD in American literature, so working in the United States or coming back always was high on our list. I will say that in our global world, how business leaders think, their priorities, the care for their teams, those things are all very, very similar, really. I've been very lucky that the senior executives we work with, that I work with, and the teams that I work with, they're all very driven. They're all, you know, change oriented. They all want to learn. They're all very highly collaborative with us. And in the last several years, whether that's been with you and your former team or other global client engagements that I've led and had the pleasure of working with, those are global teams. There's not much difference in terms of do you work with a German or do you work with an American or someone from Singapore, frankly. What I will say is that it accelerates the learning for myself, for our teams, when we have these types of opportunities. And what I mean by that is it accelerates the learning in terms of how to work with different cultures and being sensitive to different personalities, right? And that's just picking up the elements of behavior at what point dinner is being eaten, when you have a dinner between a main team and a client team, right? That is very different in Spain than if you are in the winter time in the Nordics, right? In Northern Europe, where it gets dark really, really early, right? So very, those things are different, but by and large, I think how businesses, global firms certainly today, operate is very, very similar. What I will say is there's a difference between the more traditional big scale companies that have been around for 30, 40, 50 years versus the ones that were born in the last couple of years or decades, like the last 20 years, and the work that we do in particular in California, or in the startup scene or the relative young scene in the New York area, for instance, those companies have different demands, sometimes higher demands in certain areas than traditional companies, whether that's someone in the oil and gas industry that's been around forever and will be for quite a while, right? It's just different, right? It's no better or worse, but just different. Regulated industries obviously tick very different. Since we're talking about data, right? Knowing what you can and cannot do if you're working in a regulated industry like healthcare is really, really important, right? And of course, data and privacy laws in Europe are very different from from the United States. So being very aware of that and getting good advice of how do you deal with, well, those, first of all, being aware that there could be differences, identifying those and being aware what to do with those is important as well, right? So those are learnings that come by working globally, but it's not so much about differences with executive teams and their teams.
So one quick question for you is just if you had to name one thing that you wish someone had told you when you were in school before you started working that you've come to fully understand through experience, what would that be?
Well, the one thing, the learning never ends. Don't think that you're going to work against a master's or against finishing up a PhD and you're done, right? Enjoy the ride and use this as a basis for continued learning. I think that's something I wasn't as aware of, certainly, 25 years ago as I am today.
And now there's a bunch of depressed students out there saying, I thought I was almost done, and you've ruined it for them. But that's a great point. Before we run out of time, just one last thing to close on is we've done a lot of kind of looking back or looking at the present. Let's look forward. If you look out 3-5 years from now, is there any specific trend in the world of analytics and data science that you think is coming our way fast?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So I believe very, very near term, I'll just say 5 years, right? So I tend to say we always overestimate the change that happens in the next year, and we underestimate the change that happens over the next 10 years. But I believe that very near term there is, and they're not entirely independent of each other, but very near term there's a lot of things that automation can do, right? Data-driven automation that will help facilitate speeding up processes, making them better, more error-free than what humans can do if it was still a manual task. But automation, very near term, over the next year or two, I would expect is one of the use cases broadly applicable across many industries that I'd say I would expect to see more of. And then over the next 5 years, certainly, that machine learning and subtle ways, machine learning and AI will play roles more and more in our daily lives. We might not even notice when that's going on, right? That's related to compute at the edge, for instance, and so on. But I believe that the abilities of machine learning and AI in improving everyday's lives are going to become much more pronounced than even over the last few years.
Well, these have been some great insights, and I'm sure folks will learn a lot. And I want to just thank you for taking some time out of your day to talk with me and share your insights. So thanks so much.
Bill, thank you. My pleasure.